Hello everyone, welcome back to our study of the Law of Moses. Lately we've been studying family law in the Law of Moses, so laws focusing on sexuality, marriage, divorce, remarriage. Last week we considered what kinds of things motivated ancient marriages, right? What makes a person eligible? And it paid us some dividends pretty much immediately in helping to understand why some in the Old Testament engaged in things like plural marriage, like Elkanah in 1 Samuel chapter 1, or in concubinage, like Abraham in Genesis chapter 16. And it helps us, again, understand why these sorts of things go on. It's not to try to justify any of these practices morally. And in fact, as we start, let me just repeat the same caveat that I gave last week. This is a descriptive lesson meant to help us understand what's going on in antiquity, and especially what's happening in ancient Israel. And that, in turn, will help us understand how the Law of Moses regulates the marriage relationship and why it does the sorts of things that it does. In none of this are we trying to, again, justify these things morally or give some sort of prescriptive teaching on what's going on. This is not in my way of saying this is how things ought to be today. This is just describing the way things were in the time of Moses. Now that we've introduced things, I want us to consider what the Law of Moses has to say about marriage, starting with whom you can marry. So last week we looked at who you might want to marry and why. This week we're going to look at whom you can marry. Now, part of that question is clear-cut, and we'll start with that part. Let's start with the easy stuff. But another part of that question is honestly more complex than I initially thought it was going to be. I'd planned on jumping just straight into betrothal this week, and what looked like it was going to be a fairly minor point in the study turned out to be bigger than I anticipated. God's Word has a way of doing that, doesn't it? But let's start with the clear-cut and easy stuff. There are clear restrictions in the Law of Moses concerning whom a priest can marry. We're going to turn to Leviticus chapter 21. We're going to read the first 15 verses. And the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, 'No one shall make himself unclean for the dead among his people, except for his closest relatives, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, or his virgin sister, who is near to him because she has had no husband. For her he may make himself unclean. He shall not make himself unclean as a husband among his people, and so profane himself. They shall not make bald patches on their heads, nor shave off the edges of their beards, nor make any cuts on their body. They shall be holy to their God, and not profane the name of their God. For they offer the Lord's food offerings, the bread of their God. Therefore they shall be holy. They shall not marry a prostitute, or a woman who has been defiled, neither shall they marry a woman divorced from her husband, for the priest is holy to his God. You shall sanctify him, for he offers the bread of your God. He shall be holy to you, for I, the Lord, who sanctify you, am holy. And the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by whoring, profanes her father. She shall be burned with fire. The priest who is chief among his brothers, on whose head the anointing oil is poured, and who has been consecrated to wear the garments, shall not let the hair of his head hang loose, nor tear his clothes. He shall not go into any dead bodies, nor make himself unclean, even for his father or for his mother. He shall not go out of the sanctuary, lest he profane the sanctuary of his God, for the consecration of the anointing oil of his God is on him. I am the Lord. And he shall take a wife in her virginity. A widow, or a divorced woman, or a woman who has been defiled, or a prostitute, these he shall not marry. But he shall take as his wife a virgin of his own people, that he may not profane his offspring among his people, for I am the Lord who sanctifies him." So we see that the priests in general may not marry any woman who has been defiled, someone who has been a prostitute, who's been divorced. They have to be sexually pure. The high priest has the additional restriction that he can't even marry a widow either. The wife that he takes must be a virgin from among his people. Now notice in the high priest's case, there's this special concern with the holiness of his offspring, and that's why we have the additional restriction. We've seen how ancient Near Easterners were generally concerned with legitimacy, and that's one of the primary eligibility factors for men who are looking for wives in antiquity. Just as we saw last week. Now, it's especially true of the high priest who is carrying the lineage of Aaron. If that chain of legitimacy is broken, then the high priest is no longer one of the sons of Aaron. Right? The point emphasized in both paragraphs is that the priests and the high priest are to be holy. And we want to pay special attention to that. There is a holiness connection between marriage and what the priest is doing before God, right? His status before God. This is consistent with everything that we've seen up to this point in the law concerning marriage and sexuality and connecting it to holiness. Marriage in general, but especially the marriages of the priests, are to be object lessons to Israel about how to be holy before the Lord. All right, now that's the simple part of the marriage restrictions. And if we were to wrap it up there, well, this would be the shortest Bible class ever. But there's also another more difficult matter pertaining to Israel at large. So we've talked about restrictions concerning the priests. What about people outside of the priesthood in Israel? Well, let's start with a question. Did the law prohibit Israel from marrying foreigners? And up until I gave this another study, I thought this was a pretty slam dunk answer. Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7. We'll read the first five verses. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it, and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons and taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and chop down their asherim and burn their carved images with fire. All right, so that seems pretty open and shut, right? I mean, it just says, literally, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, take their daughters for your sons. All right, seems pretty open and shut. We could add on top of that a restriction that we read in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 3 through 6. No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. But the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam. Instead, the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because the Lord your God loved you. You shall not seek their peace or their prosperity all your days forever. Now, this passage doesn't explicitly mention marriage, but the prohibition is against them even entering the assembly of the Lord. Right? And look at that concluding remark. You shall not seek their peace or their prosperity in all your days forever. Also look at the connection that Moses draws between this restriction and Balaam. Right? So there are two reasons given why Israel is not to have anything to do with Ammon and Moab. First, they didn't meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt. Instead, and this is the second reason, instead they hired Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. And we remember what Balaam did, not just trying to curse Israel himself, but also later on arranging things so that Israel would have relations with Moabite women who would tempt them away to serve Baal of, I've forgotten which Baal it was. We'll read that passage later on in the class in Numbers chapter 25. Baal Peor. So the connection there, this is a more general restriction against Ammonites and Moabites that would naturally include marriage, right? Along with any other kind of peaceful and prosperous relationship between Israelites and Moabites. And if we take these texts in isolation, it seems like Israel in general was to avoid intermarrying with the nations that they dispossessed, and just generally with all the rest of the nations, right? The marriages that they engage in are supposed to be within Israel, right? This is the reading I've always taken. It seems to be confirmed in the story of King Solomon's wives as well. And this example we're going to read even expands on that, right? So we had the seven nations explicitly named in Deuteronomy 7. We had the Ammonites and the Moabites named in Deuteronomy 23. The next text we're going to look at, 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 8, is going to add even more to that list. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, "You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives who were princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not wholly follow the Lord, as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrificed to their gods. All right, so it seems that the author of 1 Kings takes the same reading of Deuteronomy chapter 7. In fact, he alludes to it. He doesn't outright quote the whole thing, but he gives us the essence of the message. Concerning these nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, "You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods." All right, this is referring back to Deuteronomy chapter 7. But notice, on top of that, besides the nations listed there, right, so like Solomon's Hittite wives fall under that restriction, you also have Moabite and Ammonite wives, again, mentioned indirectly in Deuteronomy chapter 23. But then on top of that, you have this marriage with the daughter of Pharaoh, and you have marriages with Edomite women. They're not mentioned explicitly in either of those earlier passages, but they are lumped in together here in Solomon's case as marriages that he should have known better than to get into, because the law says, "Surely they will turn away your heart after their gods." And that's what the story is about, that all of these foreign women turn his heart away from fidelity to the Lord. On top of that, so this is not only the reading, you know, that I always took, this is not only the reading that the author of 1 Kings seems to take, it is also the reading of the law taken by Ezra and Nehemiah much later in Israel's history, after the return from exile. Now, when I say Ezra and Nehemiah, I'm referring to the individuals, not to the books that bear their names. That's an important distinction, and it's going to make sense why I draw that distinction later on in today's class, because think of it in terms of Moses, or you could even think of it in terms of Peter, for that matter. But let's start with Moses. Moses has two roles in the Bible. There is Moses the author, the divinely inspired author, who is recording the story, again, under the inspiration of the Spirit. And then you also have Moses, the character who acts in the story that he is recording. Now, everything that Moses the author writes is right, or it's inspired. But not everything that Moses the man does in the story is right, right, even though those actions are recorded in the inspired writings. Right? It's easy in Moses's case to distinguish between those two roles, Moses as author and Moses as man, as character, as actor, as it were. So we approve of everything that Moses writes. We don't approve of everything that Moses does that we read about in those writings. And it's obvious in Moses's case, because Moses commits his sin by striking the rock instead of speaking to it. God comes out and explicitly condemns him And all of that is recorded in the text there for us. We see the same thing happen with Peter in the New Testament. Peter, again, he serves these two roles. He is a divinely inspired author, but he's also a person that we read about doing things in the inspired writings. And we approve of everything that Peter writes, but we don't approve of everything that Peter does. Right? For example, holding himself aloof from the Gentiles, as Paul records in Galatians chapter 2. Now, just bear in mind here, again, we are reading about what Ezra and Nehemiah do. And it'll make sense later on why I'm making that distinction. Let's start in Ezra chapter 9. We're going to read the first two verses. After these things had been done, the officials approached me and said, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with their abominations. From the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands. And in this faithlessness, the hand of the officials and chief men has been foremost." Right, so Ezra mentions, or this person who, the officials who approach Ezra, they allude to these passages that we've already read, Deuteronomy 7 and Deuteronomy 23, in the list of people that they mention. We read this also in Nehemiah chapter 13. And remember, Nehemiah and Ezra were rough contemporaries, right? They're ministering in Israel at roughly the same time, shortly after the return from exile. They're both involved in the reconstruction of Israel around Jerusalem. Nehemiah chapter 13, we'll read verses 23 through 27. "In those days also I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. And I confronted them, and cursed them, and beat some of them, and pulled out their hair. And I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, 'You shall not give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons, or for yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the nations there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Shall we then listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women?'" Right, so in Ezra and Nehemiah's case, there's this conflict involving intermarriage between Israelites and foreigners. And both of these texts refer back to Israel's past. Ezra refers back to the law. Nehemiah refers back to the history, to King Solomon, which we've read earlier. And all of this, again, is what we would expect if we assume that Ezra and Nehemiah's reading of the law is correct. And again, we're talking Ezra and Nehemiah, the men, not the inspired authors. This is exactly what we would expect, right? Ashdod is a Philistine city, and if you look at Israel's history, well, of course you would never marry a Philistine, right? As we've seen, Ammonites and Moabites are generally proscribed in the law in Deuteronomy 23. Again, we read all of these, this list of people in Deuteronomy 7. Everything seems to match up. The only strange thing at this point, the only thing that might take us aback a little bit, if we're paying attention, is the resolution to that conflict, which we read about in Ezra chapter 10. The resolution that they come up with is to annul all of the marriages in question. Right now, again, almost everything seems to line up to this point. So now let's introduce the problems and why this has turned into a bigger question than I thought it would. Right, I expected this point of the study to just end there. Right, just Israel's restricted from marrying foreigners. And there are some spiritual lessons in that that we're going to get to later in this class. But the problem is that those two passages from the law that we cited earlier are not the only passages in the law of Moses that deal with foreign marriage. Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 21, and we'll read verses 10 through 14. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God gives them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you desire to take her to be your wife, and you bring her home to your house, she shall shave her head and pare her nails. And she shall take off the clothes in which she was captured, and shall remain in your house, and lament her father and her mother a full month. After that, you may go in to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. But if you no longer delight in her, you shall let her go where she wants. But you shall not sell her for money, nor shall you treat her as a slave, since you have humiliated her. All right, so here the law gives explicit permission for Israel to marry foreigners. Now, if this was the only thing going on, we might say, okay, well, right, there's not really a conflict here between this text and what we read earlier. And concerning just these texts, there's not a conflict, right? But our explanation might be, well, you have specific nations named in Deuteronomy 7 and in Deuteronomy 23, and so you just have to assume that in Deuteronomy 21, Moses is talking about when you go out to war against people other than that. Now, it's not exactly an airtight, it's not exactly airtight reasoning in and of itself, because you look at Israel's history, and who do they go to war against? Well, not just the people in, that were in the Promised Land before. You see that. You also see them going to war with Moab, with Ammon, with Edom, with the Philistines especially, and later on, we have examples of all of those kinds of marriages being condemned. Philistine, Edomite, Egyptian. It doesn't matter if they weren't explicitly named in Deuteronomy 7. So that's a difficulty with that interpretation, that explanation for how these passages work together. The problem gets worse, though. Beyond that, beyond this text where Israel is given explicit permission to marry foreigners, and the way that these marriages happen is regulated in the law, we also have several prominent examples of good foreign marriages in the Old Testament, and foreign marriages that seem to explicitly violate what we have read in Deuteronomy 7 and in Deuteronomy 23. Let's start with maybe the prime example, Ruth. Ruth is a Moabitess, which already tells us that we are running afoul, seemingly, of Deuteronomy chapter 23. And in her story, we read of two Israelite men marrying her. Her first husband, Kilian, who dies at the beginning of the book, and then Boaz, Kilian's kinsman, who marries her at the end of the book. We should note, by the way, Boaz himself is the product of a foreign marriage. Kind of the weird thing about this is that we don't actually learn that in the Old Testament. We don't learn that until Matthew's genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, where we learn that Boaz's father was a man named Salmon, spelled exactly like the fish. I know, just one of those funny things between Hebrew and English. His father was named Salmon, is an Israelite, and his mother is none other than Rahab the harlot, who was a Canaanite woman. In other words, she is explicitly forbidden, right? You're not supposed to marry a Canaanite. And you're not really supposed to marry a Moabitess either, from everything that we've seen up to this point. And yet, here we have now two examples. You have Rahab and Ruth entering into marriage with Israelite men, and there's no disapproval at all. In fact, remember, they are both part of the lineage of King David and of Jesus. And absolutely nothing is made of their heritage. There's no opposition. Whether you look in Ruth or you look anywhere else, there's There's no opposition to their marriage. All right, maybe we could try to explain away Rahab as an exceptional case because of how she helped the spies. We don't have any similar explanation for Ruth. She's just a Moabite woman. And we don't read of any kind of tension regarding her first marriage. All right, nobody steps in and says, you know, hey, Killian, you can't marry her. She's a Moabitess. We don't have anything with Boaz either. Even though in the, you know, it's an essential part of Ruth's story that they go to the city gates and they consult with the elders concerning this marriage. There's no question at any point that, wait a minute, this woman's a Moabitess and you shouldn't be marrying her. So, well, if Israel is just blanketly forbidden from marrying foreigners, why do you have two Israelites marrying Ruth? And why is Ruth given such a place of honor in Israel's history? Shouldn't those marriages have been forbidden? Again, likewise for Rahab. Both of them, Rahab and Ruth, are in the genealogy of Jesus. We can't lose sight of that. But Ruth and Rahab are not the only examples. Again, from here it gets even worse. The problem just grows. Look at Bathsheba. Now, Bathsheba herself is an Israelite, but who's her husband? She marries Uriah the Hittite. Right, Hittite marriages are explicitly forbidden in Deuteronomy 7, at least according to the reading that we have taken of Deuteronomy 7, which again seems to be the same reading that Ezra and Nehemiah have taken. Now, on top of that, Bathsheba is likely a noble woman. Her father is Eliam, and Eliam is counted among the mighty men of David. He's one of the 30. So she's not some commoner. Right, she is a prominent woman of Israel. In fact, you think of the story, you know, how is David able to see her bathing on the roof? Their houses are fairly close together. Who lives close to the king? Not some commoner, not some peasant. She is a prominent woman of Israel entering into a marriage with a Hittite. And the narrative treats her marriage to Uriah as legitimate. The whole story of David's sin with Bathsheba hinges on the legitimacy of her marriage to Uriah. If her marriage was illegitimate, if it needed to be annulled, like the marriages that we read about in Ezra chapter 10, then the story of David's sin with Bathsheba makes no sense at all. No sense. So, those are the problems in front of us. Let's turn our attention then back to Ezra and Nehemiah and start to try to make sense of all of this. What do we make of Ezra and Nehemiah and what they've done? There are some possibilities. It's possible that these particular marriages that are mentioned in Ezra 9 and Nehemiah 13 are leading to idolatry, and that it's just not reported explicitly in the text. Right? We'll say more about that in just a minute, but that's a possibility, that these particular marriages are leading to idolatry. Now, what makes their case challenging is that God does not intervene directly in their stories at all. Right? Often, the prayer of Ezra chapter 9, the prayer that Ezra offers in response to this marriage crisis, it gets compared, and I've made this comparison multiple times myself, to the prayer of Daniel chapter 9, since they're both really profound and heartfelt prayers of repentance. There is an essential difference, though, between Ezra 9 and Daniel 9. In Daniel 9, an angel of the Lord answers Daniel's prayer, and he comes immediately, right? He even says, I was sent out when you started praying. There's no answer to Ezra's prayer. And beyond that, well, where did Ezra come up with the idea to annul all of the marriages? Let's go ahead and look at Ezra chapter 10. Let's read the first five verses and pay attention. Read closely. Where does this solution come from? While Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, a very great assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him out of Israel, for the people wept bitterly. And Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, of the sons of Elam, addressed Ezra. We have broken faith with our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. But even now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. Therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all these wives and their children, according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Arise, for it is your task, and we are with you. Be strong and do it. Then Ezra arose and made the leading priests and Levites and all Israel take an oath that they would do as had been said. So they took the oath. So where does the solution come from? It doesn't come from the Lord. It doesn't come from an angel of the Lord. It doesn't come from a prophet. It doesn't even come from the law. We'll say more about that in just a second. Instead, it comes from the people, specifically this man, Shechaniah. Now, he says, let it be done according to the law. Well, what does the law tell them to do? If you're hearing crickets right now, that's because the law does not... The law doesn't say what Shechaniah implies that it says. This solution to annul all of the marriages is not in the law. In fact, in most of the forbidden relationships that we read about, so we read about those in our first class in this part of the series, you know, forbidden sexual relations, in parallel passages to the ones that we looked at, the solution, the punishment given in almost every case is death. Either that or exile. Where do we read of annulment? Where did this plan come from? It did not come from the law. Look at what Ezra doesn't do. He does not consult the Lord in what he does. All of this sends up some red flags about this whole plan in Ezra chapter 10. One thing we should remember about the period of Ezra and Nehemiah is a general lesson about post-exilic Israel. So it's true of Israel at this point in history in Ezra and Nehemiah's day, and it's true of them later on when we encounter them in the Gospels in Jesus' day. Right, we've read the Gospels, we've read Zechariah, we've read Haggai, Malachi, those are all the post-exilic prophets. The general story of post-exilic Israel is that they've not changed. They've really not changed much from before they went into exile, with the key exception of idolatry. They've put away idols. They don't turn to idolatry. They are, in fact, practically anal about it. They express a whole lot of zeal. But as we saw in Haggai's case, for example, that expressed zeal doesn't usually turn into actual zeal. We see the same thing with the Pharisees. Jesus spends a whole chapter in Matthew condemning them for that exact thing. They talk a good game, but they don't do as they say. All right, they are hypocrites. All right, you go back again to Haggai's time. They say they're going to build the temple. They just sit around and don't do it for a long time. We also see that they generally misunderstand the law, and they generally turn it to other purposes, which is how we end up with Israel in the shape it's in during the life of Jesus. It's all over the Gospels, especially all of the religious leaders that Jesus encounters. They don't understand the law, whether it's Nicodemus, who doesn't understand this basic idea you must be born again, or the Sadducees, who claim that there's no resurrection. Jesus tells them explicitly, the problem is you don't understand the scriptures or the power of God. And he explains to them from the scriptures how the resurrection is present in the law of Moses. It's a problem with the Pharisees, too. None of them understand the law. They misread it constantly. And then Jesus has to ask them explicitly, right? What does the law say, and how do you read it? Right, reread that in the Gospels. It's entirely possible that Ezra and Nehemiah, the men, have misread and misapplied the law, as we see the men of Israel doing so often. And this is why I stressed earlier that we have to divide, you know, distinguish between Ezra and Nehemiah, the men, versus Ezra, the author. And remember, Ezra and Nehemiah, they're separate books in our English Bibles. In Hebrew, they're one book, authored by Ezra the scribe. So we have to separate, it's really Ezra we have to focus on. We have to separate out Ezra the man from Ezra the inspired writer, just as we separate out Moses the man from Moses the inspired writer. And it's entirely possible that at this point in Ezra's life, he made the wrong call. It doesn't say anything, again, against Ezra the inspired author, because, again, the Spirit only has Ezra report what he did and does not report the judgment of God on the matter. That's the difficult thing about their case. In any case, so that's a possibility. We'll consider some other possibilities here in just a second. But in any case, it seems likely that we are misreading the law if we think that it blanketly forbids Israel from marrying any kind of foreigners forever. Again, you can't make any sense at all of the David and Bathsheba story if we think the law blanketly forbids Israel from marrying foreigners, and that the solution to that would have been annulment. So, if the law is not blanketly forbidding intermarriage, what is it doing? We get some key information from the laws themselves and from the examples that we cited earlier. So let's go back and consider, again, some more possibilities, not just from Ezra and Nehemiah, but from the law itself. If you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 7, this is one possibility that I have heard. I'm not completely sold on it. But it is possible that Deuteronomy chapter 7 is limited in scope to the wilderness generation. You look at the time frame that God puts on this restriction, right? The setting for the restriction. Let me get back up to Deuteronomy chapter 7 here. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you're entering to take possession of it, and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. The time frame given here is the conquest itself, right, which was carried out by the wilderness generation, right? We're talking that generation that was born in the wilderness. Remember, the generation before them died in the wilderness because they would not go in and conquer. The wilderness generation is the first generation that settles in the promised land. And Deuteronomy chapter 7 is addressed specifically to that situation. When the Lord brings you into the land, when the Lord gives these people over to you, you must devote them to complete destruction. So it is possible that Deuteronomy chapter 7 is only intended to be a blanket prohibition at the time of the conquest, in which case Rahab would be an exceptional case. Right? Rahab is still a difficulty with that because she's a Canaanite, and because she marries someone of the wilderness generation, Salmon, the father of Boaz. But that is a possibility. One of the strengths of that is that we do find other places in the law that distinguishes between what the wilderness generation is supposed to do and what the generations following them are supposed to do. So, for example, when it comes to the sacrifices, one of the things that Moses says as he's laying out the restrictions on sacrifice, specifically where you can sacrifice, is Moses says, look, when you go into the promised land, you can't be doing what we have done here today in the wilderness. Right? He explicitly draws that distinction between this is how you're supposed to act now versus here's how you're supposed to act once you have settled the promised land. The same thing is true for some of the other war laws. Right? So we read a law concerning taking war brides, essentially. In other places, the law distinguishes between warring against people after the settling of the promised land versus the war for the promised land itself. So the law lays out all these regulations for taking spoils, right? What can you take as spoils? How do you divide up the spoils? And Moses explicitly says this does not apply to when you go in to conquer the land. All right, so in other words, the wilderness generation, when they go in and they wage war against the Canaanites and all the other nations living in Canaan, in the promised land, instead of taking spoil and dividing it up as the law lays out, in that specific case, in the wilderness generation's case, they are to devote all of the cities to complete destruction, which is consistent with what we read in Deuteronomy 7. But after that point, after the conquest, then if they go to war, then they get to keep the spoils. So that is a strength of that interpretation. The difficulty, as I see it, is that in those other places, that distinction is drawn explicitly. Here's what you may do, or what you're supposed to do, after you settle the promised land, versus here's what you do now as part of the wilderness generation, and that distinction is not drawn explicitly in Deuteronomy chapter 7. So I think it's reasonable. I'm not completely sold on it. It's a possibility. The other possibility is that when you look at Deuteronomy chapter 7, the main concern is Israel's spiritual state. In fact, the way that that passage concludes is, like, here's the way that you treat them. You destroy all their idols. And at that point, the focus on marriage is completely out the window. Right? You destroy their idols. So the main concern is that that Israel not go after other gods. And obviously, for all of the good examples of intermarriage that we have in the Old Testament, we have just as many, if not more, bad examples of intermarriage. Cases like Jezebel marrying Ahab, or like Solomon's wives, and there are numerous others. There's a similar motive, by the way, in all of those cases. You know, Jezebel, Solomon's wives, they lead their husbands astray after the Canaanite gods, and after, in Solomon's case, a whole host of foreign gods. But there's a similar motive behind the Moabite ban in Deuteronomy 23. Remember, we said that law connects the ban to what Balaam did against Israel. Here's what we read in Numbers chapter 25, verses 1 and 2, and this is why I've connected it in as a marriage law. When Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. All right, so what happens to Israel, this is right after Balaam tries to curse Israel, and we read later on in the law that Balaam is responsible for what's happening here in Numbers chapter 25. Israel begins to have relations with the daughters of Moab, and the daughters of Moab draw the sons of Israel away to sacrifice to the Moabite gods. So the same motive as we see in the marriage ban in Deuteronomy chapter 7. So if the concern is primarily about Israel's spiritual state, then that explains the cases of Rahab, of Ruth, and of Uriah. Now, by the way, you know, the earlier possibility that we gave, that Deuteronomy 7 only applies to the wilderness generation, that also explains Ruth and Uriah. Right? If if later on Israel is not constrained against foreign marriage, well, then there's no question. Yeah, Ruth can marry Boaz. And yeah, Bathsheba can marry Uriah. No question about it. But this interpretation also makes sense of it if those laws are primarily concerned with Israel's spiritual state. Consider Rahab. Rahab gives up her city to the will of God. And that's the way she expresses it whenever the spies come in. Right? She knows that God is with Israel, and so she aligns herself with Israel. She binds herself to Israel. That's what we read in the book of Joshua. Joshua tells us that Rahab joins Israel and lives in Israel even to this day, Joshua says. So at the time that the book of Joshua is being written, Rahab's descendants are still in Israel. Right? Rahab's family is still in Israel. She gives up her Canaanite identity, presumably including their gods. And the Hebrew writer lauds her faith. Right? So rather than, drawing Salmon away from the worship of God, instead, she is drawn to the worship of God, which makes her, legitimate marriage material in the law's eyes. The same thing is true of Ruth. Rather than drawing her husbands away after the Moabite gods, Ruth gives herself over to the God of Israel. We read this famously in Ruth chapter 1, verses 15 through 17. And she, that is Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. For your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." All right, so remember, all the men, by this point in the story, all the men have died. Naomi's husband has died. Her two sons have died, the husbands of Orpah and Ruth. And Orpah, Ruth's sister-in-law, has decided to go back into Moab and to go back to her father's house. And Naomi encourages Ruth to do the same thing. And notice the way she phrases it. Go back. Orpah has gone back to her people and to her gods. You should do the same, Naomi says. And Ruth does not just repudiate her people, but also repudiates her gods. She completely gives up her Moabite heritage and marks herself out as an Israelite. "Your people shall be my people," Ruth says. She is giving up her own native people. "Your God shall be my God," she says. She gives up her native gods. She gives up Chemosh. "Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried." And it's hard to overstate the importance of that in the ancient mind. She gives up her claims on Moabite land and attaches herself to the Promised Land. Right? This is a huge deal. Where you die and where you're buried is important, right? Remember what happens to the bones of Joseph. Right? He's not buried in Egypt. He's entombed there temporarily, but they bring him back to the Promised Land. And likewise, before him, Jacob, whenever he dies, they don't bury him in Egypt. They take him back to Canaan, where he had lived. Where you die and where you are buried says a lot about who you are, in this case, were. And Ruth says, "I'm going to die where you die, and I'm going to be buried there." So she has completely given up anything relating to her Moabite identity and has aligned herself with Israel. And most importantly, she has given up the Moabite gods and given herself to the God of Israel. It seems that Uriah is of the same caliber as Ruth. He's a Hittite, but from what we can read in his story, he has rejected his Hittite heritage for a place in Israel. Much of that is evident in the story itself. You can see Uriah's devotion in the way that he refuses to go back to his house. Right? David, he calls Uriah back to try to trick him to go in and have relations with Bathsheba so that whenever, you know, all of a sudden, oh, now there's a baby, Uriah will think, oh, it must be mine, right? David's trying to trick him into a, you know, into fathering, to providing for an illegitimate child. And Uriah refuses. He doesn't know anything about the pregnancy, obviously. Instead, he is keeping himself consecrated for battle, even when he's at home. He's completely devoted, not just to David, but to Israel. Right? Remember, Uriah is also one of the mighty men of David. He has a high position in Israel. Even his name indicates that he has given up his Hittite heritage. Uriah is not a Hittite name. He's taken on a Hebrew name. It means flame of God, right? He has taken on an Israelite identity. The Yah in Uriah refers to the God of Israel, to the holy name of the God of Israel. So Uriah and Ruth and Rahab all fit into this pattern of foreigners who do not lead their spouses astray from the Lord to follow other gods. Instead, they go in the other direction. They give up their foreign gods, and they worship the God of Israel. So let us return one last time to Ezra and Nehemiah, because part of the difficulty with Ezra and Nehemiah, with their case, what they do in their stories, is that this spiritual element of the law that we see in the law itself, that we see in the lives of Rahab, Ruth, and Uriah, it's secondary at best in Ezra and Nehemiah's cases. And at worst, it's just flat out absent. Right? Nehemiah at least mentions Solomon's idolatry, which came about through his foreign wives. So it's at least somewhat present in Nehemiah's case. But here's the thing, there is no evidence of idolatry in the book of Nehemiah. There's no evidence that these marriages are leading to idolatry. That's why we said earlier we might just have to assume that maybe these were idolatrous marriages. It's not stated that there's any kind of idolatry going on in that case. Instead, the chief problem in Nehemiah, the chief problem that's stated, is that the offspring of these marriages speak some Philistine dialect instead of speaking Hebrew. Again, remember, Ashdod is a Philistine city. So when he says they speak the language of Ashdod instead of the language of Judah, he's complaining that they don't speak the right language. Right? That ought to sound familiar to us, by the way. They speak some dialect of Philistine instead of speaking Hebrew or Aramaic. In Ezra's case, the spiritual component is completely absent. Right? Shechaniah kind of alludes to it. Right, if we go back up to Ezra chapter 9, let me get the text pulled up here. In Ezra chapter 9, Shechaniah says, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with their abominations. From the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites." So he says they've not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with their abominations. That almost kind of implies that maybe there's some idolatry going on, but that's not what Shechaniah says later on. Right? It's also entirely possible he is just... The concern is that they've not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands. And he's just associating the peoples of the lands with pagan abominations. For, he says, "They have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands." That's Shechaniah's concern. The holy race has mixed itself with some of the peoples of the lands. The word translated race here, by the way, is the Hebrew word for seed. Right? We're talking about offspring. We're talking about lineage, children. There are a couple of ways to read that. this concern might be messianic. The seed promise is a big deal in the Old Testament, and by this point in Israel's history, Israel has some kind of messianic expectation, and they understand that the Messiah is going to be descended from their own people. He's going to be a son of Israel. It was understood that the Messiah would be the offspring of David. That's why there was so much expectation regarding Zerubbabel. But that concern and Shechaniah's complaint makes no sense at all at this point in history. Right? If Shechaniah is concerned with the racial purity of the line of the Messiah, that boat sailed a long time ago. The Messianic line, again, already includes Rahab and already includes Ruth, a Canaanite and a Moabite. Right, if that's Shechaniah's concern, again, he's just flat out wrong. Otherwise, the concern seems to just be purely racial. And that's consistent with the emphasis in Nehemiah on the language of the offspring. Right, that it ultimately all comes down to ethnic and racial concerns that we don't read about in the law. Okay, even if you go back and look at Deuteronomy 7. Is that the explanation for why they're not to intermarry? Because we want you to be good, genetically pure Jews. We want you to speak Hebrew forever. That's nowhere in the law. The concern is the idolatry. So it could be, again, that the people of this day have just completely misread the law, and they're reading in a racial element to the law that the law, you know, Moses didn't intend, that's not there in the law. This is also consistent, by the way, with what we see in the Gospels, a post-exile Israel that has gone completely xenophobic, to the point that Jewish converts, even later on, Jewish converts to the Christian faith have a hard time accepting Gentiles into the faith because it is so baked in this idea of racial purity that God's people have to be part of the ethnic stock of Israel, that these Jewish converts have a very hard time accepting Gentiles into the faith. Right, and we see it in places like Mark 7, the Pharisees challenging Jesus' disciples, why don't they wash their hands when they come in from the marketplace? Because just being in contact with Gentiles makes you unclean. Again, where do you find that in the law? It's not there. We know for a fact that post-exile, that is Second Temple Judaism, turned really racist, with no basis in the law at all. Is that what happened in this case in Ezra 9 and 10 and in Nehemiah 13? It's a possibility. Again, the chief difficulty is that we don't have God stepping in at any point in the story, either to bless or to condemn what Ezra and Nehemiah have done. The short of it is that based on the total evidence of Scripture, it does not appear that Israel was completely forbidden from marrying foreigners. Anyway, we have enough examples worked in enough ways that it's not possible to say that the law of Moses completely forbade Israel from marrying any kind of foreigner. The true restriction is marrying somebody who's faithful, right? That's the real, real important thing. And we find that reflected in the law as well, right? If you or if even your wife tries, if anybody, even your spouse, tries to draw you away after other gods, don't listen to them, is what the law tells us. In other places. So that I feel like I've learned a lot this week studying this topic. Again, just at the outset, going into this study, I have always thought and always taught that Israel was just completely forbidden from marrying foreigners. At this point, I think that that's a misreading of the law. So, in the law of Moses, again, they are permitted to marry foreigners under certain conditions, under certain circumstances. So that leads us, again, up to marriage itself. And as far as I know, there's not anything else that that we need to describe or study before we get into betrothal and marriage itself. So Lord willing, and we always have to say Lord willing, next week that will be the focus of our study. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to this material, and I hope that it has been edifying to you and that you've learned something. And in the end, we hope that everything that we do equips us to be more faithful in our service to God. Right? Because this, the spiritual lesson of marriage in the Old Testament is still applicable today. Your spouse is going to have a huge impact on your spiritual life. And so you should choose wisely. And you should always, you know, a lot of us watching this are already married. Remember, you're a huge part of your spouse's spiritual life. And this is a good opportunity to question, are you being a good influence in your spouse's spiritual life? So there's some things to think on and pray on as we move forward. But until next time, we'll see you later. Bye-bye.